Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tab, also on them.
Service plan required for watch or tab. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, for part two of the President of the United States of America. We finished last week on John Tyler, the 10th President of America, and this week we're going to crack on with number 11. I think this one we're going to go up to number 20. That's the goal. But as you know from last week's episode, the goal in last week's episode was to try and cover all of them and then halfway through realize that that wasn't going to happen in the time frame. So we shall see, because it might not. To be fair, these next 10 presidents from 11 to 20, probably the most famous presidents in US history. So we have got quite a bit to cover. And like I said, these might take up a little bit more time than was first imagined. So we shall start with James K. Polk. So often referred to as the first dark horse, James Polk was the 11th president of the United States from 1845 to 1849. Now, he was the last strong president until the Civil War. He was born in Mecklenburg County in North Carolina. Shout out to NC, because I know some people from there. In 1795, studious and industrious, Polk graduated with honors in 1818 from the University of North Carolina. Go Tar Heels. As a young lawyer, he entered politics and served in the Tennessee legislature and became friends with Andrew Jackson. In the House of Representatives, Polk was chief lieutenant of Jackson in his bank war, and he served as Speaker of the House between 1835 and 1839. He left there to become the governor of Tennessee. Until circumstances raised Polk's ambitions, he was a leading contender for the Democratic nomination for vice president in 1844. Both Martin Van Buren, who had been expected to win the Democrat nomination for president, and Henry Clay, who was the Whig nominee, tried to take the expansionist issue out of the campaign by declaring themselves opposed to the annexation of Texas. Polk, however, publicly asserted that Texas should be re-annexed and all of Oregon reoccupied. The aged Jackson, correctly sensing that the people favored expansion, urged the party to basically push forwards Polk as the nomination for president, and he was actually nominated on the 9th ballot. So, who is James K. Polk? Be honest with you, this is a US president I don't know anything about. This is actually one of the big quotes as well. So, I don't know anything about him. But when he stood in Congress, the jeering from the other side basically was, who is James K. Polk? So not only do I not know who he is, even the politicians didn't know who he was. The response from the Democrat Party, short and sweet, James K. Polk is the candidate who stands for expansion. He linked the Texas issue, popular in the South, with the Oregon questions, attractive to people in the North. Polk also favored acquiring California as part of the United States. Not only that, you've got to remember, this man's from North Carolina. He's from the East Coast. He's got the East Coast. He wants the expansion to the West. He's got the Southern states as the governor of Tennessee. He's got the Northern states because of the Oregon issue as well. He is a good candidate, even if people don't know who he is. However, just before Polk could take office, Congress passed a joint resolution offering annexation to Texas. And in doing so, they bequeathed Polk the possibility of war with Mexico, and this soon severed diplomatic relations. In his stand on Oregon, the president seemed to be risking war with Great Britain. The 1844 Democratic platform claimed the entire Oregon area, from the California boundary northward to latitude 5440, which is the southern boundary of Russian Alaska. Extremists in America chanted 5440 or fight, but Polk, aware of diplomatic problems, knew that no course short of war was likely to get all of Oregon. Happily, neither he nor the British wanted a war. He offered to settle by extending the Canadian boundary along the 49th parallel from the Rockies to the Pacific. When the British Prime Minister declined, Polk reasserted the American claim to the entire area. Finally, the British settled for the 49th parallel, except for the southern tip of Vancouver Island, and the treaty was signed in 1846. Now, I've always wondered this, because when you look at any map of any country anywhere in the world, the borders are... well, they're borders, aren't they? You know, they're jagged edges and curved lines, and, you know, it's very, you know, very obvious where the borders lie. They're normally along riverbeds or coastlines or things like that. However, the 49th parallel in Canada, and if you haven't seen it, go and have a look, it is a straight line. They literally got the map of Canada, put a ruler on it, drew a straight line and went, that's yours, that's ours, end of discussion. So it's nice to know that. I've always wondered how that came about. Now I know. The acquisition of California, though, proved far more difficult. Polk sent an envoy to Mexico and up to $20 million plus settlement of damage claims owed to Americans in return for California and the New Mexico County. Since no Mexican leader could cede half of his country and still stay in power, Polk's envoy was not received. To bring pressure, Polk sent General Zachary Taylor to the dispute area on the Rio Grande. The Mexican troops, this was aggression, that's how they saw it, and they attacked Taylor's forces. Congress declared war, and despite much northern opposition, they basically supported the military action against the Mexican forces. American forces won repeated victories and occupied Mexico City. Finally, in 1848, Mexico ceded New Mexico and California in return for $15 million, an American assumption of the damage claims. So the war actually cost, not only cost Mexican lives, it cost them $5 million extra as well. President Polk added a vast area to the United States, but its acquisition precipitated a bitter quarrel between the North and the South over expansion of slavery. Polk leaving office with his health undetermined from hard work, he actually died in 1849. So he actually died the year he left office. And that led way to the next president, a man named Zachary Taylor. Zachary Taylor was a general, a national hero in the United States Army, and he fought in the Mexican-American War and in the War of 1812. He was elected the 12th president of the United States, serving from March 1849 until his death in 1850. So Northerners and Southerners disputed sharply whether the territories wrested from Mexico should be opened to slavery, and some Southerners threatened secession. Standing firm, Zachary Taylor was prepared to hold the Union together by armed force rather than compromise. Born in Virginia in 1784, he was taken as an infant to Kentucky and raised on a plantation. He was a career officer in the army, but his talk was more often of cotton raising. His home was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and he owned a plantation in Mississippi. Taylor did not defend slavery or Southern sectionalism, and 40 years in the army had made him a strong nationalist. So even though he owned slaves, even though he owned plantations, even though he was a Southerner, he didn't support slavery because he would rather have the Union together and lose slavery. He was a strong nationalist. He spent a quarter of a century policing the frontiers against the Indians. In the Mexican War, he won major victories at Monterrey and Buena Vista. President Polk, disturbed by General Taylor's informal habits of command, and perhaps his wiggery as well, kept him in northern Mexico and sent expedition under General Winfield Scott to capture Mexico City. Taylor insisted, though, that the battle at Buena Vista opened the road to Mexico City and the halls of Montezuma. So even though he wasn't given the job of going into Mexico City, he sort of took praise for the fact that he cleared the road. You know, kind of like when your wife tries to open a mayonnaise jar and she hands it to you and says, "Can you do it?" And you do it straight away and she goes, "Well, I loosened it for you." That's kind of the victory he was going for there. Old, rough and ready homespun ways were his political assets. His long military record would appeal to Northerners. His ownership of 100 slaves would also lure in the Southern votes. He had not committed himself on troublesome issues, and the Whigs nominated him to run against the Democrat candidate, Lewis Cass, who favoured letting the residents of territories decide for themselves whether they wanted slavery. So the new territories that were acquired, the Democrats said, "You can decide in your own states." The Whigs said, "Nothing." Just said nothing. And this is kind of how the election happened in the UK. You know, we had Labour on one side, Conservatives on the other side, and Labour won the election by not actually saying anything. They didn't have to say anything because the Tories have been so bad for so long that Labour kind of just had to sit there and not say anything, and people went out and voted for them, even though they're idiots, because people who voted Labour are idiots. And if you voted Labour, I'm sorry, just look at the state of the economy over the last 6 months. You're an idiot. In protest against Taylor, the slaveholder and Cass were the advocate of squatter sovereignty. Basically, Northerners who exposed the expansion of slavery into territories formed a Free Soil Party, and they nominated another candidate on a free ticket called Martin Van Buren. We've heard that name before. He was president before. Didn't make a difference. Taylor won anyway. So we now have our new president. Although Taylor had subscribed to the Whig principles of legislative leadership, he was not inclined to be a puppet. He was his own man. You know, you find this a lot nowadays, that presidents, prime ministers, politicians, they're just puppets of the state. He didn't want to be that. He wanted to be his own man. As disheveled as always, Taylor tried to run his administration in the same rule of thumb fashion within which he fought the Indians. Traditionally, people could decide whether they wanted slavery when they drew up a new state constitutions. Therefore, to end the dispute over slavery in new areas, Taylor urged settlers in New Mexico and California to draft constitutions and apply for statehood, therefore bypassing the territorial stage. Southerners were furious since neither state constitution was likely to permit slavery. Members of Congress were dismayed since they felt the president was usurping their policy of making prerogatives. In addition, Taylor's solution ignored several acute side issues. The northern dislike of the slave market operating in the District of Columbia, and the southern demands for more stringent fugitive slave laws. In February 1850, President Taylor had held a stormy conference with southern leaders who threatened secession. He told them, if necessary to enforce the laws, he personally would lead the army, and any persons taken in the rebellion against the Union, he would hang, with less reluctance than he hanged deserters and spies in Mexico. Then events took an unexpected turn. After participating in ceremonies at Washington Monument on the blistering 4th of July, Taylor fell ill. Within 5 days he was dead, and after his death the forces of compromise triumphed, but the war Taylor had been willing to face came 11 years later. His only son Richard served as a general in the Confederate Army. That's interesting, I think. Now, that paved way for the unlucky for some, the 13th President of America, Millard Fillmore. A member of the Whig Party, was the 13th President of America from 1850 to 1853, and the last president not to be affiliated with either the Democratic or Republican parties. So he is the last one of the old guard. In his rise from a log cabin to wealth and the White House, Millard Fillmore demonstrated that through methodical industry and some competence, an uninspiring man could make the American dream come true. Born in the Finger Lakes County of New York in 1800, Fillmore as a youth endured the simple frontiersman's life. He worked on his father's farm and at 15 was apprenticed to a cloth dresser. He attended one-room schools and fell in love with the red-headed teacher, Abigail Powers, who later became his wife. Now that's, I find that fascinating, because let's be honest, guys, and if you're a guy listening to this, we all had that one teacher, didn't we? That one teacher that you were like, yeah. So, yeah, he, I mean, to me, honest, that's he's made the American dream come true at 15 years old here. But anyway, moving on. In 1823, he was admitted to the bar. 7 years later, he moved his law practice to Buffalo as an associate of the Whig politician Thurlow Weed. Fillmore was head of state office and for 8 years was a member of the House of Representatives. In 1848, while comptroller of New York, he was elected vice president. Fillmore presided over the Senate during the months of nerve-wracking debates over the Compromise of 1850. He made no public comment on the merits of the compromise proposals, but a few days before the President Taylor's death, he intimated to him that if there should be a tie vote on the Henry Clay's bill, he would vote in favour of it. Thus, the sudden accession of Fillmore to the presidency in July 1850 brought an abrupt political shift in the administration. Taylor's cabinet resigned and President Fillmore at once appointed Daniel Webster to be the Secretary of State, thus proclaiming his alliance with the moderate Whigs who favoured the compromise. A bill to admit California still aroused all the violent arguments for and against the extension of slavery without any progress towards settling the major issues. Clay, exhausted, left Washington to recuperate, throwing leadership upon a Senator Stephen A. Douglas of Illinois. At this critical juncture, President Fillmore announced in favor of the compromise, and on August 6, 1850, he sent a message to Congress recommending that Texas be paid to abandon their claims to part of New Mexico. This helped influence a critical number of Northern Whigs in Congress away from their insistence upon the Wilmot Proviso and the stipulation that all land gained by the Mexican War must be closed to slavery. Douglas's effective strategy in Congress, combined with Fillmore's pressure from the White House to give impetus to the compromise movement, breaking up Clay's single legislative package, Douglas presented five separate bills to the Senate. Number 1. Admit California as a free state. Number 2. Settle the Texas boundary and compensate her. 3. Grant territorial status to New Mexico. 4. Place federal officers at the disposal of slaveholders seeking fugitives. 5. Abolish the slave trade in the District of Columbia. Each measure obtained a majority, and by September the 20th, President Fillmore had signed them into law. He actually wrote, "I can now sleep at night." Some of the more militant Northern Whigs remained annoyed and refusing to forgive Fillmore for having signed the Fugitive Slave Act. They helped deprive him of his presidential nomination in 1852. Within a few years, it was apparent, although the compromise had been intended to settle the slavery controversy, it served rather as an uneasy truce. It wasn't the end of it. It was just like put a thumbtack in it. As the Whig Party disintegrated in the 1850s, Fillmore refused to join the Republican Party, but instead, in 1856, accepted the nomination for the president of the Know Nothing or American Party. Throughout the Civil War, he opposed President Lincoln, and during Reconstruction supported President Johnson. He died in 1874. So, not a completely useless president for having the unlucky number 13 on his head. President number 14, Franklin Pierce. He was the president from 1853 to 1857. Franklin Pierce became president at a time of apparent tranquility. The United States, by virtue of the Compromise of 1850, seemed to have weathered its sectional storm. By pursuing the recommendations of Southern advisers, Pierce, a New Englander, helped to prevent still another outbreak of that storm. But his policies, far from preserving calm, hastened the disruption of the Union. Born in Hillsborough, New Hampshire, in 1805. Do you have a Northampton in America? There's a question for you. Is there a Northampton in America? Born in New Hampshire in 1804, Pierce attended Bowdoin College. After graduation, he studied law, then entered politics. Pierce's name was put forward for the Democratic nomination for president. He wasn't overly popular. In fact, they actually balloted 48 times and eliminated all the well-known candidates before nominating Pierce. So he was, in essence, the first dark horse president. In reality, he should never have made it that far. Probably because the Democrats stood more firmly for the compromise than the Whigs, and because the Whig candidate, General Winfield Scott, was suspect in the South, Pierce won a narrow margin of popular votes. 2 months before he took office, he and his wife saw their 11-year-old son killed when their train was wrecked. Grief-stricken, Pierce entered the presidency nervous and exhausted. In his inaugural speech, he proclaimed an era of peace and prosperity at home and vigor in relations with other nations. The United States might have to acquire additional possessions for the sake of its own security, he pointed out, and would not be deterred by any timid forebodings of evil. Pierce had only to make gestures towards expansion to excite the wrath of the Northerners, who accused him of acting as a cat's pawing of Southerners eager to extend the slavery into the other areas. Therefore, he aroused apprehension when he pressured Great Britain to relinquish its special interests along part of the Central American coast, and even more when he tried to persuade the Spanish to sell Cuba. But the most violent renewal of the storm stemmed from the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which repealed the Missouri Compromise and reopened the question of slavery in the West. This measure, the handiwork of Senator Stephen A. Douglas, grew in part out of his desire to promote a railroad from Chicago to California through Nebraska. Already Secretary of War Jefferson Davis, advocate of Southern Transcontinental Route, had persuaded Pierce to send James Gadsden to Mexico to buy land for a Southern Railroad. He purchased the area now comprising of Southern Arizona and part of Southern New Mexico for $10 million. Douglas's proposal to organize Western territories through which a railroad might run caused extreme trouble. Douglas provided in his bills that the residents of the new territories could decide the slavery question for themselves. The result was a rush into Kansas as Southerners and Northerners vied for control of the territory. Shooting broke out and the bleeding canvas became a prelude to the Civil War. By the end of his administration, Pierce could claim a peaceful condition of things in Kansas. So by the end of it, he'd fixed the problem. Sort of. But to his disappointment, the Democrats refused to renominate him, turning to the less controversial Buchanan. Pierce returned to New Hampshire, leaving his successor to face the rising fury of sectional whirlwind, and he died in 1869. This leads way to President number 15. We just mentioned him, James Buchanan, President of the United States from 1857 to 1861. He was the president immediately prior to the American Civil War, and before Sleepy Joe, he was the first and only president to be elected from Pennsylvania. As we now know, Sleepy Joe is president and he's from Pennsylvania as well. Tall, stately, stiffly, formal in high socks he wore around his jowls, James Buchanan was the only president who never had a first lady. Presiding over a rapidly dividing nation, Buchanan grasped the political realities of his time, relying on constitutional doctrines to close the widening rift over slavery. He failed to understand that the North would not accept constitutional arguments which favoured the South, nor could he realise how sectionalism had realigned political parties. The Democrats split, the Whigs were destroyed, giving rise to the Republican Party. Born into a pretty well-to-do family in Pennsylvania in 1791, Buchanan, a graduate of Dixon College, was a gifted debater and learned in law. He was elected 5 times to the House of Representatives, then, after an interlude as Minister of Russia, he served for a decade in the Senate. He became Polk's Secretary of State and Pierce's Minister to Great Britain. Service abroad helped him to bring the Democratic nomination in 1856 because he had exempted himself and was pretty popular as a debater. He was a very popular person to take that nomination. As president-elect, Buchanan thought the crisis would disappear if he maintained a sectional balance in his appointments and could persuade the people to accept constitutional laws as the Supreme Court interpreted it. The court was considering the legality of restricting slavery in the territories, and two justices hinted to Buchanan what the decision would be. Thus, in his inaugural as the president, referred to the territory in question, happily a matter of little practical importance. I think that was probably the understatement of the century. Don't worry about it. It's not that important. 4 years later, American Civil War. Since the Supreme Court was about to settle it, he wasn't really that bothered. 2 days later, Chief Justice Roger B. Taney delivered the dread Scott's decision, asserting that Congress had no constitutional power to deprive persons of their property rights in slaves in the territories. Southerners were delighted, but the decision created a furiosity in the North. Buchanan decided to end the troubles in Kansas by urging the administration of the territory as a slave state. Although he directed his presidential authority to his goal, he further angered the Republicans and alienated members of his own party because Kansas remained a slave territory. When the Republicans won a plurality in the House in 1858, every significant bill they passed fell before Southern votes in the Senate or a presidential veto. The federal government reached a stalemate. Sectional strife rose to such a pitch in 1860 that the Democratic Party split into Northern and Southern wings, each nominating its own candidate for the presidency. Consequently, when the Republicans nominated Abraham Lincoln, it was a foregone conclusion that he would be elected, even though his name appeared on no Southern ballot. Rather than accept a Republican admission, the Southern Fire Eaters advocated for secession. Now, I just want to throw one thing out there, because one of the biggest issues that I have is hypocrisy. Now, this is completely off topic, but I just, reading that, I've got to say something. If I remember rightly, when we look at the Civil War and we look at the basics of the Civil War, the Southern states wanted to keep slavery, the Northern states wanted to get rid of slavery. Therefore, officially, the Southern states were the bad guys and the Northern states were the good guys. I'm well aware, before someone jumps down my throat, that it is far more complicated than that. I know there's a lot more to it, but when you look at it as in a very, very, very snapshot. Now, most people would say that the liberals in today's society are the people who want, or who would look back in history and see the Confederates as nasty, evil, racist, homophobes and all of this. That's how the liberals would see it. And they would also say that it's disgusting that the Southern states of America refused to put Abraham Lincoln on the ballot. However, in the next breath, they were advocating for states to remove Donald Trump from the ballot in the last election. And I can't understand the hypocrisy. If you go and find a blue-haired liberal screaming in the streets and ask them, do you think the Southern states were right in 1860 to remove Abraham Lincoln from the ballot paper? I guarantee you every single one of them says, absolutely not, that's disgusting, how dare they do that. But then if you ask them the same question, should their state remove Donald Trump? It's a very, yeah, sorry, completely separate thing. But like I said, I hate hypocrisy, and I can see it so blatant there. And if you can see it as well, let me know, because I think that's pretty obvious. President Buchanan, back to the story, dismayed and hesitant, denied the legal right of the states to secede, but held that the federal government legally could not prevent them. He hoped for compromise, but secessionist leaders did not want compromise. Then Buchanan took a more militant task. As several cabinet members resigned, he appointed Northerners and sent the Star of the West to carry reinforcements to Fort Sumter. On January the 9th, 1861, the vessel was far away. Buchanan reverted to a policy of inactivity that continued until he left office in March 1861. He retired to his Pennsylvania home, where he died 7 years later, leaving his successor to resolve the frightful issue facing the nation. And now we've got probably the most famous, or if not the most, at least the second most famous president in US history. We all know number one was George Washington, and we all know number 16 was Abraham Lincoln. President in 1861 and declared that America should always be free, and those people, every man created equal. I'm not going to read the speech. I think I did the speech in probably my first ever episode, the Emancipation Proclamation. I believe that was my first episode 3 years ago. Yeah, go back to that if you want to listen to the speech, the Gettysburg Address. I think that's on there. And let's be honest, you don't want to hear it in a British accent. It's a beautiful American speech. I couldn't do it justice. Lincoln won.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Lincoln warned the South in his inaugural address, "In your hands, my dissatisfied fellow countrymen, and not in mine, is the monstrous, monumentous issue of civil war. The government will not assail you. You have no oath registered in heaven to destroy the government, while I shall have the most solemn one to preserve, protect, and defend it." So basically, God's on my side. However, if you go back 2 years into the war, it didn't really look like God was on the northern side. Lincoln thought secession was illegal and was willing to use force to defend federal law and the Union. When Confederate batteries fired on Fort Sumter and forced its surrender, he called on the states for 75,000 volunteers. Four more slave states then joined the Confederacy, but four remained within the Union, and the Civil War begun. The son of a Kentucky frontiersman, Lincoln had to struggle for a living. And he struggled in school as well. Like, his learning was really like set back at an early age. 5 months before receiving his party's nomination for president, he sketched his life. And this is from Abraham Lincoln. This is sort of snippets from his autobiography. It's not an autobiography, but anyway, this was written by Abraham Lincoln. "I was born February the 12th, 1809, in Hardin County, Kentucky. My parents were both born in Virginia, of undistinguished families and second families. Perhaps I should say, my mother, who died in my 10th year, was of a family of the name Hanks. My father removed from Kentucky to Indiana in my 8th year. It was a wild region with many bears and other wild animals still in the woods. There I grew up. Of course, when I came of age, I did not know much, Still, somehow, I could read, write, and cipher. But that was all. Lincoln made extraordinary efforts to attain knowledge while working on a farm, splitting rails for fences, keeping store at New Salem, Illinois. He was a captain in the Black Hawk War. He spent 8 years in the Illinois legislature and rode the circuit courts for many years. His law partner said of him, his ambition was a little engine that knew no rest. He married Mary Todd and they had 4 boys, only one of whom lived to maturity. In 1858, Lincoln ran against Stephen A. Douglas for senator. He lost that election. But in debating with Douglas, he gained national reputation that won him the Republican nomination in 1860. As president, he built the Republican Party into a strong national organization. Furthermore, he rallied most of the Northern Democrats to the Union cause. On January 1, 1863, he issued the Emancipation Proclamation that declared forever free those slaves within the Confederacy. Lincoln never let the world forget that the Civil War involved an even larger issue. This he stated most movingly in the Gettysburg Address, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain under this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from this earth. I did say I wasn't going to read the whole thing, so there's just a little snippet from it. Lincoln won re-election in 1864 as Union military triumphs heralded an end to the war. In his planning for peace, the president was flexible and generous, encouraging Southerners to lay down their arms and join the new reunion. The spirit that guided him was clearly that of in his second inaugural address, now inscribed on one of the walls in the Lincoln Memorial in D.C. With malice towards none, with charity for all, with firmness in right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds. Now, I do find one thing that I learned about Abraham Lincoln, and I do think this is poignant of his character, was when the war was over, he actually invited the Confederate generals to Washington. And the band at Washington, so they had a brass band, a military band, and as the Confederates came up Pennsylvania Avenue to Washington for these, whatever it was, I don't know if it was like, I think it was just a meeting. Obviously, the surrender had already been signed. But as they walked up the street, he instructed the band to play Dixie. Now, for those of you who don't know what that is, that was essentially the anthem for the Confederate States of America. And that just shows you the man. He's humble in victory. And that is one thing that is so missing in the world now, is people who are humble in victory. Humble in defeat is easy, but humble in victory is very, very difficult to do. And Abraham Lincoln was the epitome of that. However, as we all know, on Good Friday, April the 14th, 1865, he was assassinated at Ford's Theater in Washington by John Wilkes Booth, an actor who somehow thought he was helping the South. The opposite was the result for Lincoln's death, and the possibility of any reignition of the Civil War died with that bullet. So, we all know about Abraham Lincoln. How many people know about his successor, Andrew Johnson? Andrew Johnson became the 17th president of the United States from 1865 to 1869, an old-fashioned Southern Jacksonian Democrat is how he was described, And he was a Democrat of pronounced states' rights. Although an honest and honourable man, Andrew Johnson was one of the most unfortunate of all of the presidents in history. Arrayed against him were the radical Republicans in Congress, brilliantly led and ruthless in their tactics. Johnson was no match for them. Born in Raleigh, North Carolina in 1808, Johnson grew up in poverty. He was an apprentice to a tailor as a boy, but he ran away. He opened a tailor shop in Greenville, Tennessee, married Eliza McArdle, and participated in debates at the local academy. Entering politics, he became an adept stump speaker, championing the common man and vilifying the plantation's aristocracy. As a member of the House of Representatives and the Senate in 1840 and 1850s, he advocated a homestead bill to provide a free farm for the poor man. During the secession crisis, Johnson remained in the Senate even when Tennessee seceded, which made him a hero in the North and a traitor in most eyes of Southern men. In 1862, President Lincoln appointed him military governor of Tennessee, and Johnson used the state as a laboratory for Reconstruction. In 1864, the Republicans, contending that their National Union Party was for all loyal men, nominated Johnson, a Southerner and a Democrat, for vice president. After Lincoln's death, President Johnson proceeded to reconstruct the former Confederate states while Congress was not in session in 1865. He pardoned all who would take an oath of allegiance, but required leaders and men of wealth to obtain special presidential pardons. By the time Congress met in 1865, most Southern states were reconstructed, slavery was being abolished, but black codes to regulate the freedmen were beginning to appear. Radical Republicans in Congress moved vigorously to change Johnson's program. They gained the support of Northerners, who were dismayed to see Southerners keeping many pre-war leaders and imposing many pre-war restrictions upon the black population. The radicals' first step was to refuse any Senate seat or representative seat from the old Confederacy. They next passed measures dealing with former slaves, and Johnson vetoed the legislation. The radicals mustered enough votes in Congress to pass legislation over his veto, and the first time that Congress had overridden a president on an important bill in their history. They passed the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which established black men and women as American citizens and forbade discrimination against them. A few months later, Congress submitted to the states the 14th Amendment, which specified that no state should deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Now, I did an episode a few months ago where we spoke about the due process of law in that 14th Amendment. What that basically means is slavery you cannot have. However, if somebody has gone through the due process of law and has been incarcerated, then the 14th Amendment doesn't apply. And this is one of the reasons why the American penal system is one of the worst in the world. Because essentially, written into your constitution is, if you commit a crime, we can make you a slave. There is one of the unwritten parts of that, or one of the interpretations of that, is if you commit a crime, that you have no rights. Now, to an extent, I do agree with that. I'm all for things like capital punishment and using the full extent of the law to punish people. However, there is no rehabilitation when you treat people like that. So you're kind of just creating this circle of criminals to come in and out of prison. So yeah, that's why Americans' penal system is one of the worst, and anyone who's been through it or knows anything about it, which I only know about, I've never actually been through it, thank God, will agree with me on that. However, we're back to the story. All the former Confederate states except Tennessee refused to ratify the amendment. There were two bloody race riots in the South. Speaking in the Middle West, Johnson faced hostile audiences as well. The radical Republicans won an overwhelming victory in the congressional elections that fall. Autumn. In March 1867, the radicals effected their own plan of Reconstruction, again placing southern states under military rule. They passed laws placing restrictions upon the president, and when Johnson allegedly violated one of these, the Tenure of Office Act, by dismissing Secretary of War Edwin M. Stanton, the House voted 11 articles of impeachment against him. He was tried by the Senate in the spring of 1868 and acquitted by only one vote. He returned as Senator for Tennessee in 1875, but he did die a few months later. So, next president, probably one of the most famous men in US history, but I knew he was a president, but I wasn't 100% sure he was a president. You know, it's like one of those things where you can never be 100% sure that it's true. Well, turns out that the next president, President number 18, was Unconditional Surrender Grant. In 1865, Commanding General Ulysses S. Grant led the Union armies to victory over the Confederacy in the American Civil War. He's an American hero. Grant was elected the 18th President of the United States 4 years after, in 1869, and he was president for 8 years until 1877. Late in the administration of Andrew Johnson, General Ulysses S. Grant quarreled with the president and aligned himself with the radical Republicans. He was, as the symbol of the Union victory during the Civil War, their logical candidate for 1868. I mean, yeah, no shit. He was probably the most famous man in the world, or at least the most famous man in America. He's a war hero. He won the Civil War. He ended the bloodshed. He essentially ended slavery. The man was, yeah, there was no way he was not going to win this election. When he was elected, the American people hoped for an end to turmoil. Grant provided neither vigor nor reform, looking to Congress for direction. He seemed bewildered. One visitor to the White House noted a puzzled pathos, as of a man with a problem before him which he does not understand the terms. Now, this I do understand, because he wasn't a politician. He was an officer. He was a general. He may have been a good speaker. He may have been good at leading men. You know, he may have done a little bit of politics in his early years, but essentially, he's a fighter. He's not a politician. So yeah, I can understand that in his first term, he may have looked a little bit out of his depth. Born in 1822, Grant was the son of an Ohio tanner. He went to West Point rather than doing his studies against his will, and graduated in the middle of his class. So he wasn't the best, but he wasn't the worst. In fact, the best at the time was General E. Lee, and I believe the worst, or one of the worst, was Jefferson Davis, if I remember rightly, from one of the podcasts I did previously. I think Jefferson Davis was one of the bottom of the class at West Point. In the Mexican Civil War, he fought under General Zachary Taylor. and at the outbreak of the Civil War, Grant was working in his father's leather store in Galena, Illinois. He was appointed by the governor to command an unruly volunteer regiment, and Grant whipped them into shape. By 1861, he had risen to the rank of brigadier general. He sought to win control of the Mississippi Valley in February 1862. He took Fort Henry and attacked Fort Donelson. When the Confederate commander asked for terms, General Grant replied, "No terms except unconditional and immediate surrender can be accepted." The Confederates surrendered, and President Lincoln promoted him to Major General. And that's where he got his nickname, Unconditional Surrender Grant. At Shiloh in April, Grant fought one of the bloodiest battles in the West and came out less well. President Lincoln fended off demands for his removal by saying, "I can't spare this man. He fights." For his next major objective, Grant maneuvered and fought skillfully to win Vicksburg, the key city on the Mississippi, and thus cut the Confederacy in two. He then broke the Confederate hold on Chattanooga, and Lincoln appointed him General-in-Chief in March 1864. Grant directed Sherman to drive through the South while he himself, with the Army of the Potomac, pinned down General Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia. Finally, on the 9th of April, 1865, at Appomattox Courthouse, Lee surrendered. Grant wrote out magnanimous terms of surrender that would prevent treason trials. So that was one of the things that was written in by a previous president, that anyone who fought against them would basically be hung. Well, Grant made sure that that didn't happen. As President Grant presided over the government, much as he had run the army. Indeed, he brought part of his army staff to the White House as well. Although a man of scrupulous honesty, Grant as a president accepted handsome presents from admirers. Worse, he allowed himself to be seen with two speculators, J. Gould and James Fisk. When Grant realized their scheme to corner the market in gold, he authorized the Secretary of the Treasury to sell enough gold to wreck their plans. But the speculation had already wrung havoc with business. During his campaign for re-election in 1872, Grant was attacked by liberal Republican reformers, and he called them narrow-headed men, their eyes so close together that they cannot look out of the same gimlet hole without winking. The general's friend in the Republican Party came to be known proudly as the Old Guard. Grant allowed radical Reconstruction to run its course in the South, bolstering at times with its military force. After retiring from the presidency, Grant became a partner in a financial firm, which went bankrupt. About that time, he learnt that he had cancer of the throat. He started writing his reconciliations to pay off his debt and provide for his family, racing against death to produce a memoir that ultimately earned $450,000. Soon after completing the last page in 1885, he died. As the 19th President of the United States from 1877 to 1881, Rutherford B. Hayes oversaw the end of Reconstruction, began the efforts that led to civil service reform, and attempted to reconcile the divisions left from the Civil War. Beneficiaries of the most fiercely disputed election in American history, Rutherford Hayes brought to the executive mansion dignity, honesty, and moderate reform. To the delight of Women's Christian Temperance Union, Lucy Webb Hayes carried out her husband's orders to banish wines and liquor from the White House. Born in Ohio, 1822, Hayes was educated at Kenyon College and Harvard Law School. After 5 years of law practice in Lower Sandusky, he moved to Cincinnati, where he flourished as a young Whig lawyer. He fought in the Civil War and was wounded in action. He rose to the rank of Brevet Major General while he was in the Army in Cincinnati. Republicans ran him for the House of Representatives for Cincinnati, and he accepted the nomination but would not campaign, explaining an officer fit for duty who at this crisis would abandon his post to an election ought to be scalped. Elected by heavy majority, Hayes entered Congress in December 1865, troubled by the rebel influences ruling the White House. Between 67 and 76, he served 3 terms as governor of Ohio. Safe liberalism, party loyalty, and a good war record made Hayes an acceptable Republican candidate in 1876, and he opposed Governor Samuel J. Tilden of New York. Although a galaxy of famous Republican speakers and even Mark Twain stumped for the Hayes, he expected the Democrats to win when the first returns seemed to confirm this. Hayes went to bed, believing that he had lost. But in New York, Republican National Chairman Zachariah Chandler, aware of a loophole, wired leaders to stand firm. Hayes has 185 votes and is elected. The popular vote was apparently 4.3 million for Tilden and I'm trying to read that in small numbers. 4.3 million for Tilden, so 4,300,000, and 4,036,000. Hence why I couldn't say 4.3 again, but 4,036,000 for Hayes. Hayes' election depended upon consented electoral votes in Louisiana, South Carolina, and Florida. If all disputed electoral votes went to Hayes, he would win. A single one of them would elect Tilden. Kind of similar to the last one we had, if Trump won Pennsylvania, there was no way Harris could win, barring getting all of the 7 swing states that were left. I think if I'm right, I'm not 100% on US politics, but I think if I'm right, that's how it had to go. Months of uncertainty followed, and in January 1877, Congress established an electoral commission to decide the dispute. The commission, made up of 8 Republicans and 7 Democrats, determined all the contests in favour of Hayes by 8-7. Yeah, no shit. All the Republicans said the Republicans won, all the Democrats said the Democrats won. The final electoral vote was 185-184. Northern Republicans had been promising Southern Democrats at least 1 cabinet post. Federal patronage subsides for internal improvements and withdrawal of troops from Louisiana and South Carolina. Hayes insisted that his appointments must be made on merit and not on political considerations. For his cabinet, he chose men of high caliber, but outraged many Republicans because one member was an ex-Confederate and had bolted the party as a liberal Republican in 1872. Hayes pledged protection for the rights of blacks in the South, but at the same time advocated the restoration of wise, honest, and peaceful local self-government. This meant the withdrawal of troops. Hayes hoped such conciliatory policies would lead to the building of a new Republican Party in the South, to which white businessmen and conservatives would rally. Many of the leaders of the South did indeed favour Republican economic policies and approved of Hayes' financial conservatism, but they faced annihilation at the polls if they were to join the party of Reconstruction. Hayes and his Republican successors were persistent in their efforts, but could not win over the solid South. Hayes had announced in advance that he would serve only one term and retired to Spiegel Grove, which was his home in Fremont, Ohio, in 1881, and he died 12 years later in 1893. And your last and final president for this podcast is President number 20, James Garfield. He was elected as president in 1881 after 9 terms in the House of US Representatives. His presidency was impactful but cut short after 200 days because America has a gun problem and he was assassinated. Sorry, I know that's going to really trigger some people there, but it just came out. It's not wrong, but it just came out. As the last of the log cabin presidents, James A. Garfield attacked political corruption and won back the presidency, a measure of prestige that it had lost during the Reconstruction period. I'm not even going to try and pronounce that. He was born in Ohio in 1831. Unfortunately, he was fatherless at 2. He later drove canal boat teams, somehow earning enough money for an education. He was graduated from Williams College in Massachusetts in 1856, and he returned to the Western Reserve Eclectic Institute in Ohio as classics professor within a year. He was made its president. Garfield was elected to the Ohio Senate in 1859 as a Republican, and during the secession crisis, he advocated coercing the seceding states back into the Union. In 1862, when Union military victories had been a few, he successfully led a brigade at Middle Creek, Kentucky, against Confederate troops, and at 31, Garfield became a brigadier general, 2 years later, a major general. Meanwhile, in 1862, Ohioans elected him to Congress. President Lincoln persuaded him to resign his commission, and it was easier to find major generals to obtain effective Republicans for Congress. So it was basically he could find more generals than he could find congressmen, which is crazy when you think about it. He won election repeatedly for 18 years and became the leading Republican in the House. At the 1880 Republican Conference, Garfield failed to win the presidential nomination for his friend John Sherman. Finally, on the 36th ballot, Garfield himself became the dark horse nominee. We've heard that term before. By a margin of only 10,000 popular votes, Garfield defeated the Democratic nominee, General Winfield Scott Hancock. As President Garfield strengthened federal authorities over the New York Customs House, stronghold of Senator Roscoe Conkling, who was the leader of the stalwart Republicans and dispenser of patronage in New York. When Garfield submitted to the Senate a list of appointments, including many of Conkling's friends, he named Conkling's arch rival William Hay Robertson to run the Customs House. Conkling contested the nomination and tried to persuade the Senate to block it, and appealed to the Republican caucus that it needed to be withdrawn completely. Garfield would not submit. This will settle the question whether the president is registering clerk of the Senate or the executive of the United States. Shall the principal port of entry be under the control of the administration or under the local control of a factional senator? That's a quote from Garfield. Conkling manoeuvred to have the Senate confirm Garfield's uncontested nominations and adjourn without acting on Robertson. Garfield countered by withdrawing all nominations except Robertson's. The senators would have to confirm him or sacrifice all the appointments of Conkling's friends. In a final desperate move, Conkling and his fellow senator from New York resigned, confident that their legislature would vindicate their stand and re-elect them. Instead, the legislature elected two other men, and the Senate confirmed Robertson, and Garfield's victory was complete. In foreign affairs, Garfield's Secretary of State invited all American republics to a conference to meet in Washington in 1882, but the conference never took place. On July 2, 1881, in a Washington railroad station, an angry attorney who had sought a consular post shot the president. Mortally wounded, Garfield lay in the White House for weeks. Alexandra Graham Bell, the inventor of the telephone, tried unsuccessfully to find the bullet with an induction balance electrical device which he had designed. On September the 6th, Garfield was taken to the New Jersey seaside. For a few days, he seemed to be recuperating. But on September the 19th, 1881, he died from an infection and internal hemorrhage. So, there we have it. The next 10 presidents from 11 to 20. Some pretty famous presidents in that. And two assassinations in 10 presidents. So, yeah, not a great hit record here. I mean, I think it was Donald Trump that actually said on, I'm sure it was a Joe Rogan podcast, the statistics for attempted assassinations or actual assassinations on the president makes the president of America statistically the most dangerous job in the world. Just let that settle in, America. You know, you've had 47 presidents. Well, you're going to have 47 next year. And 47 presidents. Three have been shot at and not killed, including Donald Trump. Four have been shot and killed. I mean, that's pretty bad. I mean, that's 7 out of 47. It's almost 25%. It's not far, it's not 25%. It's actually more like 20%. But even so, I mean, it's a high percentage. I don't even think it's that high in the army. In fact, I don't even think the British death rate in the army for the Second World War was 20%. So yeah, the President of America, one of the most dangerous jobs in the world. But I find that extremely fascinating. Some of those men there, absolute legends of history, will always go down in history as far as I'm concerned. So yeah, fantastic. We're going to revisit this next week. We're going to go back to the next 10. So we're going to go from 21 to 30. Again, for all of you listening, if you want to get ahead, these episodes will be going on Patreon first. So get yourselves over to Patreon. I'm not going to bang on about it because we did last week. So, yeah, thanks for listening, guys, and we'll see you next time.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.